And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and we're honored to welcome Mark Bowden to the program today. Mark Bowden is a renowned journalist and author. He recently had the cover story of the July-August 2017 issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine about how America and the world should deal with North Korea. He is perhaps better known for his nonfiction books, including The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden, Our Finest Day, D-Day, June 6, 1944, and Black Hawk Down. Today we'll be discussing Hue 1968, which is a look at the longest and fiercest battle of America's involvement in the Vietnam War. The combined North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces seized control of South Vietnam's third largest city on the eve of Tet, the nation's biggest holiday. It would take almost a full month for South Vietnamese and American forces to regain control of the city that was almost leveled during the fighting. Now, Mark, when I was growing up, I remember some people use the cliche in referring to the Tet Offensive as winning the battle and losing the war.
Right. Well, that's what people say. I think you have to define terms. I mean, if you narrowly define the Battle of Hue as taking back the city, then the American forces and the South Vietnamese forces succeeded. That's what they set out to do, and they did take the city back. But they destroyed it in the process of taking it back, and they lost a lot of people. In the process, I think a lot of confidence in the South Vietnamese government was lost on the part of the civilians living in that part of South Vietnam. And in fact, since there were Tet Offensive attacks throughout the country, a lot of South Vietnamese people were no longer as certain that the government in Saigon was going to prevail. And I think that it's probably fair to say that most people in South Vietnam were waiting to see who was going to win the war. I mean, you could get killed siding with one or the other faction. So I think it was a serious blow to South Vietnam's prestige. And then, of course, in the United States, where the American president and the American military had sold the Vietnam War as a fairly easy mission, that, in fact, Westmoreland had come back to the United States in November of 1967 and basically said things are going great and American troops are going to start being withdrawn in the foreseeable future. And then wham, comes the Tet Offensive, where Americans saw fighting comparable to what they had seen in World War II. This was not at all the kind of war that they had been sold. And I do think it ended up triggering or really accelerating opposition to the war, which became something that ultimately led to our withdrawal.
Now, it was really intriguing to read that the goals of the Tet Offensive varied and that there was not kind of a party line on what they hoped to achieve with these simultaneous strikes around the south of Vietnam. So what were kind of three or four of the big purposes of this?
Well, I think it's true of any huge undertaking like this. I mean, you had the official goal of the Tet Offensive, which was to take back the cities of South Vietnam, in particular to take the city of Hue, and to trigger a general uprising where the expectation was that the people of South Vietnam would rise up in support of the revolution and that the South Vietnamese government would be defeated and the Americans would be forced to withdraw. And that was what I call the songbirds of Hanoi's propaganda version of what was going to go on. When you talk to the military men who had a far more practical view of the world, who had a much more realistic sense of what they were up against, they'll tell you we knew from the start that the best we could do, we could take the city, but we could only hold it for a couple of days, and that we would lose a lot of men when the counterattack came. I think that the more naive troops, the young people like Che Ti Mung, who was the village girl who fought with the Viet Cong, they believed the propaganda, and they were convinced that they were striking the blow that would end the war once and for all. You know, they ended up, I think, being disillusioned by that, but they interestingly didn't lose heart in their cause.
And it seems like romanticism was a problem on both sides of this idealization of their side, but not really line up with reality.
And again, Stephen, I think that that's probably true of any war or any large-scale enterprise like this. People get involved in the fighting in Vietnam for their own reasons. And if you bear down, as I've done, to the guys on the street, or in the case of Che Ti Mung, the women on the street, they have their own personal reasons. You know, Che had a family that had been fighting for independence in Vietnam for generations. So this was a cause that was, you know, very personal to her. Her older sister had been killed. She had been arrested and interrogated. And so she was angry and felt very fervently that she was doing the right thing. American Marines, you know, are there for hundreds of different reasons. I mean, every person you talk to has a different story of how they ended up in the Marines. You have very idealistic young men who wanted to do right by their country, who felt it was their obligation to serve, and who accepted the idea that it was important for the United States to stop the spread of communism wherever it reared its head around the world, and they were there to do their part for humanity. And then you had guys like Lonnie Connolly, who wanted desperately to avoid going to Vietnam, and so he joined the Navy because he thought, well, Vietnam is a land war, so if I join the Navy, I'll be on a ship. And then when he fills out his form to be, you know, recruited, they ask him to describe, you know, what MOS it's called, what his occupation specialty would be. And he ended up naively putting down corpsman because his mother was a nurse and he'd been around clinics and blood didn't bother him. And little did he know when he wrote corpsman down that the Marine Corps doesn't have medics. They use Navy corpsmen. So, and they needed Navy corpsmen because they lost a lot of Navy corpsmen. So if you wanted to be a corpsman, and during the war in Vietnam, you would be in Vietnam in short order. And so sure enough, he ended up smack in the middle of Hue, you know, trying to patch people up.
But corpsmen didn't last long in the field normally.
Well, no, and that's right. And that's why they needed them so badly. And so when Lonnie, you know, wrote down that he was interested in being a corpsman, little did he know he was choosing an occupation specialty that would get him a rapid trip to Vietnam, which it did.
Now, it seemed like the people in the cities of the south of Vietnam, as you said, they didn't seem really touched by the battle that was going on up north. They were a little bit complacent and really not overly involved in what was going on elsewhere in their country.
I think that was particularly true in Hue. Hue University was there. It was a government center. It was a religious center. It was the, you know, ancient cultural capital of Vietnam. It represented a kind of intellectual elite in the country. And because of the cultural importance of Hue, the war had bypassed it. In fact, most of the fighting, at least during the years from 1965 to 1968, when the American forces really became directly involved, most of the fighting was in the hills or out in the countryside. So the cities saw very little fighting. Saigon a little bit more than Hue. So the people of Hue had gotten, I think, lulled into a sense that the war was on the periphery of the country and didn't really directly affect them. And certainly that was true of the American troops that were stationed in Hue, who saw it as a sort of a rear positioning, you know, where they didn't really believe they would be engaged in any active fighting.
Now, you've painted a fascinating portrait of this month-long battle, but how did you first become interested in it yourself?
Well, to be honest, you know, it was suggested to me by my publisher and editor, Morgan Entrekin, some years ago. And we have conversations where I give him ideas of things that I want to do, and he has ideas of his own. And his idea really grew on me for a number of reasons. I knew that the Tet Offensive had been the pivotal moment in the war in Vietnam, or at least that was my sense of it. Really, only when I started looking at it, I was unaware of what a huge part of the Tet Offensive, the Battle of Hue, was, that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese had actually taken the third largest city in South Vietnam and held it for nearly a month. So it was, if you want to understand the Tet Offensive, you needed to understand the Battle of Hue. So I became convinced that understanding this battle, which was the bloodiest and longest intense battle fought in the war, would give me an opportunity to really explore what the Vietnam War was all about. I'm a journalist, so I'm a storyteller. And a historian might look at the war in Vietnam and decide to write a 7-part history of the war. I prefer, and this is true of a book like Black Hawk Down, you know, to find one important dramatic moment in a story. And I think if you dig deeply enough into that story, in a way, it gives you a lens on the larger story. So I became convinced, you know, that if I could really understand what happened in Hue, that I would gain a deeper understanding of the whole Vietnam War. And I'm 66 years old, so I was 16 when this battle was fought. I was a sophomore in high school. The Vietnam War was really the first issue that really engaged me as a kid. I mean, I actually remember I started subscribing personally to Time magazine when I was in high school because I wanted to learn more about what was going on in Vietnam. I started to read newspapers. I started to look for books because I would have these arguments with my father over the war. I was against it, even though I didn't know enough to have a well-informed opinion. And he was in favor of it. And I would say probably the same thing for him. But he would always challenge me and say, how do you know that? Or where did you read that? Why do you believe that? And so I would research. And I went out and actually started researching things. So in many ways, for me in my life, you know, the Vietnam War was the thing that sort of set me on a path toward becoming a journalist and a writer. So it just struck me as a project that both personally and professionally was worthwhile.
And in the epilogue of the book, you talk about how the Vietnamese people you spoke to were very kind of confused about why you would hone in on this one topic.
And even just, you know, why I'm so interested in the American War, because for them, you know, some of these people I interviewed fought against the French, and then they fought against the Americans, and they fought against the Cambodians, and they fought against the Chinese. And for them, the war was a thing that lasted for almost 20 years until they gained their independence. To choose, you know, just the American War and then to choose just one episode from the American War was, you're right, it was something that they were kind of confused by. But I felt pretty good about it. I mean, as I've described, I look for a compelling and dramatic story, and I'm an old newspaper man, so I know a good story when I see it. And to me, there's value in telling a story well. And I think you end up learning a great deal about larger things when you, even if you focus very narrowly.
Now, what gave the front, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army, the NVA, the ability to be more successful in Hue than, say, in Saigon?
Part of it was that it was not as well defended as Saigon was. Saigon was the capital of South Vietnam, and so there were, you know, significant military forces in place around the city. There was the American military command in Saigon. Hue was a place where there had been very little fighting, and especially over the Tet holiday, that's the biggest holiday of the year in Vietnam. So generally, the South Vietnamese Army would give their soldiers furloughs, which is what they did in the days leading up to the Battle of Hue. So Hue was relatively lightly defended. There was no expectation that Hue itself would be attacked, and there was certainly no expectation that it would happen over the Tet holidays. The other big reason was that I think that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong had a high level of support in the rural areas around the city, because there's no way that you can amass an army of 10,000 without someone noticing. And no one in the months prior to the last day of January of 1968 sounded an alarm to the South Vietnamese army or to American forces. So, you know, they knew they could assemble that force secretly, and they knew they could take the city, and they knew that it would have a tremendous impact both in South Vietnam and also in the United States.
Now, the American military believed the next big attack would come at Khe San.
Right.
Why did they believe that?
Well, it was because General Westmoreland had made a study of the French War, which culminated in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, where the Viet Minh, at that time there was no North Vietnam, it was just the Viet Minh and independence movement, had attacked a French, isolated French outpost near the Cambodian border. And they had defeated the French there, which opened up the northern part of the country to their forces. It was such a devastating defeat for the French that they withdrew. That was the culminating battle. Westmoreland became convinced that there were troops that were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, infiltrating into the northern part of South Vietnam, and that Khe San sat right in the middle of that trail. And if they could take Khe San and defeat the Marines who were based there, it would open up the Ho Chi Minh Trail for an influx of troops into the northern part of the city. And he also felt that it was the kind of blow to the American military effort that would be potentially catastrophic, because he had sold this war as an easy one and had assured everyone that American forces were winning. And it was just the place where he chose to make a stand, because he was convinced that that's where they were going to attack. And he was determined that his forces would not be defeated. And it became an obsession, I think.
Did Kaesong come under attack at all during the Tet Offensive?
It did. It was a feint. They did initially amass troops, and they launched essentially mortar attacks, and they did send some infantry toward Kaesong. And there were some battles fought toward the end of January of 1968, but then they withdrew. Many of the forces that initially had gathered around Kaesong moved over to take part in the invasion of Hue. The outpost at Kaesong basically just was isolated and under bombardment for about 6 months, while General Westmoreland blanketed the countryside around Kaesong with probably the largest tonnage of bombs ever dropped anywhere in the world in human history over those months, just turned it into a moonscape. No big attack ever came at Kaesong, but, you know, maybe it didn't happen because General Westmoreland made sure it didn't happen. But meanwhile, that was the Tet Offensive.
Well, and it seems if there is the one major sin of the American side was arrogance. Arrogance and underestimating the capabilities, both strategic and militarily, of the front. And arrogance to not trust the intel and recon you're getting from your officers in the field.
Right.
And then the arrogance to command Marines and soldiers to undertake operations that they can't survive and will not be successful anyway.
Right. And to me, frankly, that was the most surprising thing that I learned when I researched this battle. I went into it without any real opinion about how our military conducted itself and, you know, about Westmoreland himself. I really didn't know enough about him. But as I learned, first of all, about his obsession with Kaesong, which I think played into the hands of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, enabling them to launch this enormous surprise attack, and then how he refused to believe the reports coming in from the CIA, from his own officers in the field. It defined for me a certain kind of arrogance and sort of a prototype of command stupidity. I mean, people to this day talk about General McClellan, who was the Civil War commander who built this fantastic Union army but didn't want to fight it. You know, how Lincoln labored with this general who wouldn't march his army into battle. And you know, he sent him a note one time saying, if you're not going to use your army, could I borrow it? And so McClellan stands as a sort of a prototype of a certain kind of general whose personality stood in the way of him being successful. And I think Westmoreland is a prototype of a different sort, and that is the general who has such a clearly defined theory of the battlefield and of what can and can't happen that it's impervious to facts, so that the reports that came in from his men in the field contradicted what he believed to be true, and he went with what he believed to be true instead of what he was being told.
Now, how many forces did the front have in Hue, and how many did Westmoreland think they had in Hue?
Roughly 10,000 soldiers occupied Hue on January 31st of 68, and Westmoreland that day estimated their number to be about 500. So what's that? I said he
was off
by a factor of 20. And, you know, over subsequent days, as more and more reports came and more American units were being sent on what were effectively suicide attacks against this much larger entrenched force, it gradually sunk in, you know, certainly to the field command at Phu Bai, that this was a much larger force than they thought. It never really sank in to Westmoreland, as far as I can tell. I mean, I'm reading his cables back to Washington throughout the month, and every one of the cables says, oh, there's a little fighting left to do in Hue. They should be finished up there in a couple of days. And then you go back and you see what he wrote 4 days later. And then again, it's like a couple days, you know, they're almost gone. He never admitted, even in his memoir, which he wrote some 20 years later, that he had been taken hugely by surprise and that Hue was the major battle of the war. He basically lived his whole life, I think, in denial.
Was it because it was a defensive war that they weren't trying to take over North Korea that they decided to use body count as the main metric of success?
And you meant to say North Vietnam, but it's understandable because thinking about North
Sorry.
Korea these days. But it wasn't a defensive war. You know, the mission the United States undertook was to preserve the government of South Vietnam. it was ostensibly a democratically elected government. It wasn't true. It wasn't. But it was what we labeled a democracy. And so the idea was to fight initially the Viet Cong, which was the guerrilla movement in South Vietnam, and also then to prevent the troops from North Vietnam, which was the capital was Hanoi, to prevent those troops from infiltrating to the south and overthrowing the South Vietnamese government. So in that sense, it was a defensive war. But the tactics that Americans employed were very aggressive and offensive. They were basically doing search and destroy missions where they would go looking for enemy forces and kill them wherever they could find them. The problem was finding them. And the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were very skilled. They would do ambushes. You know, they would hit American forces and then vanish. And it was their country. They knew it better than other people. They could blend into the civilian population fairly quickly. So it was a very frustrating war for the Americans.
Because so much of the fighting had been in the rural countryside up until this point, we do get to say North Korea at this point, honestly, it had been since 1950 in the North Korean occupation of Seoul that America had really engaged in urban combat, and so there were very few people who were practiced at it.
Right. You know, and we'd fought actually two big battles in Seoul during the Korean War. That was in the early 1950s. So here we are in 1968. And there are now Americans, you know, who have served more than one tour in Vietnam. The Marines went for 13 months, and the Army sent their soldiers over for a one-year tour. One of the problems, I think, in that war was there was a constant turnover of personnel, so no one really developed, you know, deep experience. But those who did have experience had been fighting in rice paddies and had been fighting in jungles, and that's what they'd been trained to do. And so now suddenly they're fighting in a major city. You know, and I interviewed a lot of these American troopers and Marines, and some of them told me they had no idea there were even cities like that in South Vietnam. You know, they'd basically been flown to an American air base, and they've been out in the countryside the whole time that they were in country. So the idea that there were tall buildings and highways and bridges and, you know, a busy urban center with restaurants and clubs and hotels and all these things came as a real shock. And then to fight in that kind of environment is also terrifying and difficult, and they weren't ready for it.
So initially, there was a reticence to have collateral damage of the art and the buildings of the city, but that pretty much went by the wayside soon enough.
It did. I mean, there were good intentions at the start. Interestingly, there was more concern about preserving buildings than preserving the civilians who were trapped in the city. Again, I think this is part of a failure to understand the dynamics of fighting in an urban environment. I think when you're fighting in the countryside, you know, the villagers would flee if there was going to be a battle. And so there was never a real concern about civilians getting caught up in the middle of a fight. In Hue, for various reasons, which I explained, there was really nowhere for these civilians to go, and they found themselves trapped in the middle of this battlefield. Nevertheless, the concern initially was for the Buddhist temples, the emperor's palace, for the important cultural treasures of Vietnam, and American forces didn't want to be responsible for destroying them. Again, also, that was part of the initial miscalculation, because if the assumption is that, oh, there's only a few pockets of enemy soldiers and we've got to clean them out, let's be careful not to knock down any buildings. When you begin to realize that they're everywhere and they're occupying every building in front of you, and the only successful way of uprooting them is to attack and destroy, you know, those buildings, very quickly those rules of engagement changed.
Tell us about the civilian toll that was taken during this battle.
Well, you know, the estimates are 5,000 to 6,000, 7,000 civilians who were killed. I suspect that's a low number, but I can't prove it. There were a lot of ways to die in Hue during that month. For one thing, the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong began rounding up civilians who were accused of working for the Saigon government or being friendly with the Saigon government, being traitors, essentially. And these people were either executed on the spot or marched off to re-education camps from which they never returned. So there were probably thousands of civilians. Again, nobody's making an accurate count of this, but thousands of civilians who were executed by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And then there were the larger number of civilians who were killed in the shelling and in the bombing and in the crossfire as this enormous battle waged, you know, for nearly a month through their neighborhoods and houses. So I know if you go to Hue today and you talk to people who remember that month, they'll tell you that there's a dead person, there's someone buried under every square foot of that city. So my suspicion is that the count of 5,000 to 6,000 civilians is probably low.
In your research, how many people did you talk to in Vietnam? You touch on a little bit in your epilogue about kind of the party line being maintained mm-hmm. with government officials supervising some of these discussions.
Right. I made two trips, one in 2015 and one in 2016, and I think I probably interviewed 60 or 70 Vietnamese veterans and civilians, people who were there, you know, during this battle. Today, Vietnam won the war, and I think it is part of the narrative that Hanoi tries to maintain about the war, that this was an independence war against the Americans to throw them out of the country. In fact, it was a civil war as well, and there was tremendous division within the country. So something like the purges that took place where they were executing civilians is inconvenient history for the Vietnamese. They choose not to emphasize, you know, that great division in their society which created that war. And so civilians who were talking to me and military people will talk readily about their fighting against Americans, but they're much less willing to talk about fighting against fellow Vietnamese or to acknowledge the bloodshed of the purges that took place when the front took the city.
How is Hue taught and the Tet Offensive taught in West Point and in Annapolis nowadays?
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that question. I do know this sort of shorthand, which you mentioned at the top of the show, that we won the war militarily, but we lost it because of the media or, you know, because of public opinion, is not believed by serious military historians. In fact, General H.R. McMaster, who's now President Trump's national security advisor, wrote a book called Dereliction of Duty, where he very effectively castigates the military leadership in the war in Vietnam for losing the war. David Petraeus wrote his doctoral thesis about command errors and military mistakes in Vietnam. There are a few scholars, and I presume these are the people who would be teaching at the academy, who would make the argument that the United States won the war in any fashion at all. You know, I think they would be, like me, quick to point out, you know, you have to understand the war you're fighting. And we definitely did not win that war. And so what are the ways that we lost it? Well, you know, one of the ways we lost it was Hue.
Was that the turning point for the American media coverage as well?
It wasn't completely, because the media had already been reporting on the war's failure for several years before Tet. You know, these are reporters who go to Vietnam, and because they were given a license to travel anywhere in the country they could get to, as long as they could hitch a ride on a helicopter or a plane, they would be out in the field talking to the young officers, Marines and soldiers, who were actually fighting. And the story that they were getting contradicted the official accounts that the military command in Saigon was putting out. And so a lot of reporters, on the basis of their own work in the field, had begun writing about the failures in tactics and strategy in Vietnam. I think for journalists, the attitude that we were losing this war shifted into the mainstream after Tet. And Walter Cronkite is a good example. Walter Cronkite was the anchorman for CBS, and he was an old World War II era war reporter. And he had been delivering on the nightly newscast kind of the official line about the war for a number of years. And yet, some of his own younger reporters had been sending back reports that contradicted the official line. Cronkite, nevertheless, was pretty much in support of the war effort until Tet. And at that point, he saw something happen that so directly contradicted what he was being officially said and what he was reporting that he decided he wanted to go to Vietnam and do his own reporting and see for himself what was going on. And he came back convinced that the American military was lying about what was going on and that the war was not going well. And his very famous broadcast said he felt that the very best that we could hope for was to negotiate an honorable withdrawal. And I think at that point, it wasn't just the media, but the American public attitudes began to shift as well.
Now, while we're dealing with all these major government and military actions and forces, you give us an insight into a lot of personalities of people who were involved in the battle as well. Let's start off with storyteller.
Oh, yeah, that's Steve Mernson. You know, it was a job description that I was unaware of until I wrote this book. But the Marines had what they called combat correspondents. And these were guys who were essentially reporters, but they were Marines. And they would travel, just like civilian reporters, around the country to various sites of fighting. And they would write stories about Marines. And the only thing different was that their mission was to write upbeat stories about Marines and, you know, and support the war effort, which is something obviously civilian reporters have a different mandate. But Mernson had seen a lot of combat because he'd been writing these stories, which ran in Stars and Stripes and were often picked up on the wire services and run in small newspapers around the country. And he landed in the middle of Hue right in the very beginning and kept notes. He was a wonderful person for me to interview because, unlike most Marines, he was always writing stories and thinking of stories. And he kept diaries of his actions over the month that he was there. And those sorts of details were and are invaluable to a writer like me. I try to construct my stories from the ground up. So unlike an academic historian who might look at the Battle of Hue and say, okay, I'm primarily interested in the significance of this event and how and why these large policy decisions and tactics, you know, were made, I am interested in those things, but I'm more interested, frankly, in capturing the experience of the event, you know, through the eyes of as many participants as I could find. And Steve Mernson, who they called Storyteller, was for me a treasure. You know, if I had been there myself, I couldn't have done a better job of paying attention and interviewing people and taking notes.
What about Captain Coolican and the Huck Bao?
Well, Jim Coolican is one of the real heroes of the Battle of Hue, and he was one of those field commanders who, from the very beginning, was telling his superiors that this is not a small force of enemy in this city. We're fighting against an enormous, well-entrenched enemy. And Coolican had been working as an advisor to an elite South Vietnamese army unit called the Hoc Bao, which means Black Panthers. And, you know, they were a very skilled fighting force. And even though Coolican, who was 25 years old, a Marine captain, he was ostensibly there to give them advice, he learned very quickly that the men he was supposed to advise knew a hell of a lot more about infantry tactics and war fighting than he did. His value to them, which he would be the first to tell you, was that he had a radio with which he could call in airstrikes and artillery. And so he, you know, worked very closely with the Hoc Bao on the eve of Tet, because so many of the Hoc Bao members were given furloughs to go home for the holidays. He headed down to the small American compound in Southern Hue, basically just to hang out over the holidays with fellow Americans and drink beer and barbecue. And it turns out they were the only place in all of Southern Hue that was not taken by the enemy when they took the city. And so he ended up in the middle of the fight to hold off the front on the first night of Hue. And then once they secured that compound, he ended up in the middle of the battle flying up to the northern part of the city inside the huge fort, which forms the northern part of Hue, the citadel. And he rejoined his unit, the Hoc Bao, and was in on the fighting right up until the last day of the battle. So for my purposes, again, you know, to find someone who was present on the ground, actively engaged in fighting from the beginning until the end, was a godsend, as was the fact that Coolican is a very articulate, intelligent man, won the Navy Cross for his heroism during that battle, has had a lot of time to think about it over the years, and has tremendous insights into how and why things happen. He became an important source for me in the book.
And early on, you mentioned the young woman, Che, and in the epilogue, you talk about how her life proceeded in, and she had quite a path even after this battle.
Yeah. Initially, the women who were in the Viet Cong units were used to help carry the wounded off the battlefield, to deliver food. And eventually, because they took so many casualties, she was pressed into the fighting. She was badly wounded and carried off the battlefield. So her wounds healed. She was sent to North Vietnam, where she went to school to be a nurse and then to be an ophthalmologist, continued fighting with the North Vietnamese forces in a medical role up until the end of the war. And I met her in Hue, where she's, you know, she's a few years older than me. She's still working as an ophthalmologist. She drove up on a scooter to our interview, and she was wonderful. I mean, just rich memories. One of these people who has detailed memories of things that happened a long time ago and has a facility, I think, you know, for telling her stories well and also with real emotion. She lost a lot of her good friends in the battle, and she's nevertheless very proud of her service, and she's as proud as any American would be who fought in an effort to throw a foreign invading army out of her country.
Can't remember if I read in the epilogue or some associated reading I was doing for this interview, there's a strange echo to the most recent presidential election, because in that election of 68, Nixon promised he had a secret plan,
right,
to end the war.
Well, he said he had a plan, and when he was asked to say what it was, he declined. So I don't believe he ever actually used the words that it, secret plan, but it became, and it was well known because I remember it. He was running for office with a plan to end the war in Vietnam, which he chose not to share with anyone. You know, he got elected, and what he did was expand the war for another 6 or 7 years. And frankly, you know, when I researched the Battle of Hue and the Tet Offensive, you know, one of the things that struck me was how much the architects of the war in Vietnam, men like Robert McNamara, like the Kennedys, had soured on this war by 1968. Robert McNamara was the defense secretary, and he was telling President Johnson, we cannot win this war. We need to start figuring out how to get out of Vietnam. This is in 1968, even before the Tet Offensive. And so with that then came the Tet Offensive. Johnson decides he's not going to run for re-election. In fact, announced that he was going to spend the remainder of his term trying to bring the war in Vietnam to an end. And America elects a president who does not share any of that perspective and plunges the United States back into another 5 or 6 years of fighting. Another 500,000 people died. The war spread into Cambodia, led to the Khmer Rouge, which killed millions of people. The consequences of that election were catastrophic in Southeast Asia. And frankly, I don't think our country has ever fully recovered from it either.
You've looked at so much of American history, going back to D-Day, coming up to the present, and you've looked at the military, you've looked at our sports. Are you just amazed on how many mistakes we love to make over and over again?
Yeah, but I think that's, you know, human nature. I don't think studying history gives you precise insights about how the future will unfold. It ought to, it seems to me, teach us more. I mean, I do think we still, as a country, try to make changes in places around the world without fully understanding the context that we're entering. And we have a tendency to elect leaders who are scornful of history and its lessons, who are guided more by their ideology than by any real knowledge or understanding. I think that's what got us into Iraq. I think that Donald Trump could very well get us involved in a war in Asia without any real understanding of what the consequences of that might be. And you see periodically in American history an effort to rid from the halls of power people who bring historical knowledge and understanding. You see it going on right now with the undermanned State Department and the scorn that the Trump administration has for the State Department. This is an enormous arm of the United States government that sends people to live in places all over the world to learn languages, to understand the history, to understand the culture and politics of the specific areas. It's an invaluable tool to any policymaker in the White House. To neglect the State Department is to, it seems to me, burn your library. I mean, it condemns you to being ignorant about what you're doing. And I, you know, so this is a strain that runs through all of American history. And I think it makes you, I think it's fair to say you get frustrated as you get older because you've learned more, you value learning, and then you see the country will elect someone who has no appreciation for it at all.
Did McNamara come from the corporate world?
He did. He was the chairman of General Motors or Ford.
Yeah.
He was a wunderkind. He was considered to be the smartest business manager in the world, and that's why Kennedy tapped him to run the Pentagon.
And now we have Tillerson as the head of the State Department.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, and some business leaders are brilliant and I think bring fresh ideas to any organization, but you've got to give them support. I mean, I don't think Tillerson has even filled the second tier positions in the State Department. It's a travesty what's going on in Washington right now.
Well, is there another topic that's gathered your attention for your next project?
No, I'm busy promoting this book and will be for the next few months. And I'm going to take my time before I plunge into anything else. I've just wrote a piece for The Atlantic about North Korea, which was on the cover of their July and August issue. That's something I've done since I finished writing this book. And I've got a couple of other magazine projects that I'm working on, but I haven't settled on another book.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's really been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Stephen. I enjoyed it.
Mark Bowden is the author of Hue 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam, which is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library and Information Center, a division of the City of Memphis. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Email us at wyplfm@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee 38111. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library and Information Center. All rights reserved.